lo and behold, ladies and gentlemen, season 5 of Chewing the Gristle is upon us. It's been a little while, folks, but it's going to be worth the wait. We're going to be featuring a lot of convivial conversations with various musical potentates, most of which you've heard of. Some are going to be some new discoveries. That's why I'm here, to bring forth the chewable gristle matter to you via the information superhighway. Brought to you, of course, by our friends at Wildwood Guitars in beautiful Louisville, Colorado, and our friends at Fishman Transducers of beautiful Andover, Massachusetts. Both I've had great long-standing relationships with and continue to do so, and we're very grateful for their continued support in this endeavor of giving you the highest quality and chewable gristle possible. Now, without any further ado, folks, let's get down and dirty with some Chewing the Gristle Season 5. Buckle up. This week on Chewing the Gristle, we've got the mighty Larry McCrae, blues man, powerhouse extraordinaire, sings like a doggone bird and plays the guitar with the intensity of 1,000 suns. We've had a good time over the years jamming here and there, and we had a good time chatting this week here on Chewing the Gristle, Larry McCrae. Well, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, once again, we convene for another juicy rendition of Chewing the Gristle with yours truly, Gregory Cock. I'm here with the mighty Larry McCrae, blues man extraordinaire, hailing originally from Arkansas by way of Detroit, Michigan, or vice versa. And where are you coming from? Where are you from right now? Where are you at right now?
I'm at home in Bay City, Michigan. I live in Bay City now. Bay City, Michigan, right on Saginaw Bay. We jump in the bay and we in Lake Huron in a matter of, you know, few miles up the bay.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So how you been doing? What's the latest? What's happening?
Man, well, I've been doing pretty good. You know, we saw each other back in the winter doing the Devin Allman, the Allman Betts family reunion or revival. That's right, family revival. So since then, I came home and I've been working some with my own band. And I just come back from Georgia. I was in Atlanta, Georgia, working with some musicians down there. And the drummer was the son of the great Candy Staten, vocalist, you know, from the 70s and R&B music. Yeah. So it was a lot of fun.
Excellent.
Well, yep, I was in Macon and Atlanta. Sorry, man.
I was going to say, we sure had fun with the Allman thing. I mean, I was only on a few of the dates, but it was always a highlight getting to play Soulshine with you and to rock out.
Man, well, I'm always flattered on it anytime I can share the stage with you. So, I mean, that was great for me, too.
Oh, it was a blast. That's a good time. That whole thing is really an interesting collection of folks. And there's just such a cool vibe about everything. I think that, you know, Devin and Dwayne are so cool in the fact that they have no problem sharing the spotlight with everybody and lets everybody do their thing. And it's diversity. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, really, really cool.
Yeah, it was really diverse, man, because within many artists, everybody's style is definitely going to be different, but they found something to accommodate everybody. And I thought that they really do a good job with that.
Absolutely. You know, I remember the first time we hung out was back at Summerfest. That was a while back.
You know what I think about? I think about them days now, and I tell that story all the time. I didn't know what kind of head whooping I was in for that day, man, but I discovered Greg Cock, and I was glad because, you know, it was just the right vibe, man. And, you know, we've been friends a long time now, so happy to know that we're still out here doing it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's good to be alive, isn't it?
Step one.
Exactly. Correct. Yeah. So tell me a little bit about how you ended up from Arkansas up into the Michigan area, and what was your playing situation like? I know you worked for a while for GM. I mean, when did you just say, I'm just going to play and that's that? Or was it kind of off again, on again?
Okay. Well, I'll start at the bottom first. I come from a little old town, man, in Arkansas called Smackover. And so the reason I did some research on it just recently to find out what Smackover was all about or what that was or whatever. So, you know, with the different dialects of English that we have from different areas of the country, and especially you want to, you know, put 100 years or a couple hundred years onto it, it's no telling what it was like then.
Right.
But the smack over came from some French derivative of sumac.
Ah.
You know, so I guess it was, in which I do know, it was a lot of sumac in the ever, you know, they call it poison ivy,
right.
Poison oak. You know, so it was a lot of that stuff going on. But what I also find out that it had the country's largest oil deposit that was over 60 square miles big. They found a pool over 60 square miles big in Smackover, Arkansas, where I come from.
Wow.
So it's just another example of, you know, the powers that be, the big money come in and clean up all the money, and then the people that live there remain the poor folks. You know?
Oh, of course. Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's the American way.
That's right, right. So in 1972, my parents decided to pull up and come to Michigan, and I'm one of formerly nine siblings.
Uh-huh.
And at the time, you know, when I come to Michigan, it was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of us boys all working for General Motors.
Okay.
So it was a whole different thing than what it was in Arkansas in 1960.
Right.
So, you know, it was kind of a liberation or a heavy burden lifted when we left, although that's where our hearts still remain. You know, you never forget where you come from.
Right.
But sometimes change is good, you know.
Now, as far as your musical formation, did that start when you were... when you were younger, or did that come later on, or was your family musical? I mean, did people in your family play?
Well, I come from a family that's all my family did besides work. You okay. know, came from my dad, my grandmother, my big sister. I have three brothers that play. You know, so many of us play, and all the ones that didn't play sang.
Okay,
you know, and that's kind of a getaway or a family way of having fun. Like I said, you know, it was in a real depressed area. And, you know, it was no financial way to make money other than hard labor. So, you know, hauling pup wood, you know, working in the field, you know, doing all this crazy stuff was still going on in 1960. And, you know, so I'm the last of, I think that my generation is the last of that old way. So by this time, my sister, who was 18 years my eldest, she was a guitarist. It just came from our grandmother and from my dad, but her name was Clara. So Clara had a band. She was the first one that had a band in the 60s when I was just a baby. So the late, great Michael Burks, you know Michael Burks, his dad and my sister had a band together. Michael was from Camden, Arkansas, which was just down and around the bend from Smackover, where I came from. And so that's how that him and my sister got hooked up and, you know, joined forces them and became a band. So I was too young to experience it other than sometime it would be a gospel rehearsal at my house where these ladies would come over and sing and my sister would play guitar. So I seen that, but she moved away in 65. She came to Michigan. So after she left, every summer she would come home and visit the family and bring her guitar and play for the family. So when my little bud is 5 or 6 years old, I saw that and heard that, man, that, you know, it put a fire in me from right there.
Awesome.
And so as the powers would be would have it, in 72, when she came home for the summer, she told my mother, she said, "Mom, I'm going to take Larry back with me and let him spend the summer up there. And, you know, I'll send him back, you know, by the time it come time for school." Well, little did I know that, you know, the whole plan would change after a couple months I got into it. And my mother decided that the whole family was leaving. And about 6 months later, they all came and joined me in Michigan. She told my sister, put him in school. And that was that. So I lived with my sister. She had a guitar. I could put my hand on it.
Uh-huh.
You know, I could touch it, you know.
And what kind of guitar was it? Do you remember?
It was a SG. I believe it was somewhere in the early 60s, a red SG Gibson guitar.
Cool.
Double pickup.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. It's still in the family. Her daughter has it. I wanted to get my hands on it, but, you know, I didn't make a fuss about that. I guess it was due to her because it belonged to her mom. You know what
right,
I mean?
Sure.
Yeah. But see, her three children were raised up just like brothers and sisters to me.
Right.
I'm only like 5, 6, 7 years older than all of them. And right. I'm their uncle.
Sure.
So they were more like little brothers than they was nieces and nephews.
Right.
And so we all, at one point, we all had a band together. We were the McCray brothers or the McCray family. And it was our two nieces and a nephew and three brothers.
Wild.
You know? Yeah.
And what kind of material was your sister doing?
Oh, she was doing stuff like Freddie King, Albert Collins, Mississippi Fred, B.B. King. She was a picker. She basically played kind of like how I play, but, you know, with a more of a bluesy thing. You know, I think I, as modernized, I took it a little further than what she did, but the root core of the blues music that I play, all my embellishments in blues came from her.
Wild.
You know. So after I got into General Motors, I worked for General Motors for almost 13 years. And I had got contacted, I got involved with Point Blank Records, which was a, you remember Point Blank, you know, back in, I think they had their first release in 1990. Well, I was contacted by them in 87.
Okay.
So in 88, I recorded my first record. In 1990, it came out, and I had been on that line, and I had been wanting to get off and do something else. And I just said, well, I just jumped out the window, man. And one day I left out of there. I never went back.
Right.
And I started playing music, and my first tour was in UK, and I was Gary Moore's support band.
Oh, nice.
Still got the blues tour.
Awesome.
And that, you know, that's from my childhood all the way up to the beginning of when I got started playing.
Now, were you always a Flying V guy? Was that your thing from very early on?
No. What happened was I went to Europe, like I said, to open for Gary, and I had a Stratocaster.
Okay.
And the mic that he got out of that Les Paul and the Fury and the Tone, I know I said, oh, hell, that's the sound. I want to play humbuckers. I wanted a bigger sound, you know?
Right.
And so when I come home, I didn't... at that time, I didn't even know I liked Les Paul because I never played one.
Right.
But I wanted humbuckers. And I come home and I saw a Tobacco Brown V guitar that was hanging up in my local music store. And it had humbuckers and all this stuff. And I was a huge fan of Albert King.
Yep.
So it almost came like me calling myself paying a tribute to him. And I want to be like him. So I'm going to get a guitar like him, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Awesome.
So that was in 91, I think, 91, 92.
Now, are you writing your own tunes at this point? Or are you doing covers or kind of a mixture of the both?
Both, kind of a mixed bag.
Got it.
And that's still kind of where my bag is at today, although I try not to do covers anymore. I try to, if I want to do a cover, I try to write something in the vein of that, or similar, but not the same, you know, but do that style if something is gnawing at me that hard, you know what I'm saying?
Sure. Now, as a guitar player and as a band leader, do you prefer a smaller band or do you like a bigger band in terms of being free to play and do your thing?
I like to have slightly more than just a core rhythm section. I mean, you know, some people can go out with a three-piece and sound full, but if you haven't developed that style or focus on it for a long time, it's hard just to do that. That's something you have to work at.
Sure.
Well, for me and for my style and for my vocal style, for original music, I like to have a little help in the rhythm section.
In the rhythm department, the comping.
Yes, because, you know, I know a few chords, but I'm not one of these guys that know a million chords and just can sound broad by myself. You know, I think I got a good sense of rhythm. I think I can play funky if I want to, but you know, I'm a self-taught player and I don't have the theory that I think it takes that a lot of players out here have.
So when you're, you know, back in the day when you're going over and playing, did you have like a tone that you were like a particular amp setup you like to use, or were you just kind of like, I just plug in and turn it up and let the good times roll?
Well, I was always fiddling around, feeling for it, trying to find it. Like I said, Gary was a big influence on me in that, you know, when I seen how that he was running his stuff. So when I came home, I got me, I was playing the, what they provided for us on tour was the pink knob Fender Twin, the hybrid, called the Twin.
Oh yeah, the red knob Twin.
Red knob, yeah. So I was playing one of those. So I wanted to go a little bit beyond that. So when I found out what a Saldana was, Gary was the first person I'd ever seen one of those.
Right.
And I come home and I asked about him. Nobody had it. Well, I was in Memphis, Tennessee, and at the Strings and Things, I went in there one day and there I said a purple head Saldana. It was a Hot Rod 50.
Yep.
Is what it was. And it was benchmark number 50. But at the time, this was in around about 1991 or two.
Okay.
They wanted like $900 for it. That was a good penny, you know, back then. But I dug a little deeper and I found it.
Right.
And I got that amplifier, man.
Yeah,
and
those SLO 100s were really expensive. The Big Daddies, man, those were pricey.
But for me, you know, that was a step up from using, you know, stock Fenders, you know, or sure. Other, you know, anything else, you know, that I never had nothing like that. And when I felt the power of that 50 watt amp through Selection 30s.
Okay. Yep.
Four of them, 12 inches.
Yeah.
And they were wired both ways. They were wired in series and parallel.
Got it.
So, you know, you could play it 4 ohm, 16 or 8 ohm. But that cabinet, man, you know, with all that power and a little sustained help right there, it was really great. It was a nice experience. Nothing like I'd ever had before.
Yeah, the Saldanas are something else. I'm actually looking at a little Saldana amp right here that I'm trying out. They got this new 20 watt one called the Astro.
The little Astro video.
20. The little
the
one.
Little
yeah.
One. Yeah.
Excuse me. Yeah. It sounds great. They're making those amps again.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because back then, you know, I was talking with a buddy of mine today, and I was like, you know, back in the day, Saldana, that was the amp. I mean, you know,
it was.
Clapton was using one. You said Gary Moore was using one. Warren Haynes was using one. I mean, Dave Edmunds, Mark Knopfler, everyone used Saldanos back then because it was like the new Marshall.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Hot rodded up.
And do you find it to kind of be that way, like a beefed up Fender Marshall kind of thing going on? I don't know so much about.
Yeah, it's definitely a Marshall. Yeah, that Marshall vibe. Beefed up
Fender. Yeah.
Yeah, Warren still uses one.
Yeah.
You know, as far as like Clapton's ladder tones, I mean, that 24 Nights record, that live record, that's like I had back in the day, and they reissued it not too long ago, kind of a longer, all of the recordings. And he was using that Saldana and that stuff, and that was a solid tone.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was.
Solid, viscous sounds. But yeah, they were. I bought a little Saldana back then. Mid 90s. It was just, I think it was a Rocket, or was it another Astro 20? It was a little like 30 watt combo amp, but it did that real overdrivey. I mean, the overdrive of a Saldana is like nothing else. I mean, it is a singing, thick, glorious sound.
Oh man, I had mine upstairs at the apartment once when I used to hang out with Paul and them in Chicago. And I'm up there, I got that Saldana just going for everything it worth. And that door popped open and it was Luther Tucker. And he said, "Hey man, what you got?" You know, like that. And I explained it to him and I showed him the app and everything. But that was, you know, that really, I'll never forget it. You know, I'm just up there doing my thing and it caught his attention. He wanted to see what kind of amp that was putting out that sound.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, did you miss reverb at all when you were playing those amps? Because I'm now getting back into amps without reverb. And I might put just a little bit of delay on it. But it's weird because for years, it's like I always just needed a little bit of reverb. And on those amps where you have no reverb, it's kind of like, well, what do you do? But then when you're playing big places, you don't really miss it.
No, and I found out something else. Even if you want to dial it for the bluesier tone, right, when you find your clarity and everything, you know, and have your mids right to whether they're not cloudy, right, but you still hear your tone, you don't really need it.
Right.
So once I got used to not having it, when I would go in different places and play, like you said, then you'll find that in most rooms, there's a natural reverb anyway.
Exactly.
And you end up not missing it.
Exactly. So what are you using these days? Do you still use that old Soldano or no?
No. You know, I got old and got tired of toting gear.
So I understand.
I got a friend that do a pretty good mod on the Deluxe Reverb.
Okay.
Defender Deluxe. And the only thing that he does is changes the speaker.
Right.
And instead of 6 V6s, I play 6 L's in mine.
Oh, nice.
And he does a thing with the bias that...
So it's a little louder.
A little louder and just a little less breakup so I can get up to probably 5 or 6 before my Deluxe started breaking up.
Got it.
You know what? If they, on a regular, by the time... Yeah, you're four or five.
Exactly. It's rasping up.
Yeah.
Interesting. So you just use the one amp?
Two of them, but mostly I use that, and I use a Blues Junior a lot too, because you know
I'm playing
smaller rooms a lot of times. So that little amp has got a big enough bite that when they put a mic on, I don't need no more.
Yeah, I hear you. A
lot of people say, man, you playing through that little amp right there? And I'm like, yep, that's what I'm using right there. that with a clone or anything to give you just a little breakup and sustain, and you're good.
Yep, exactly.
And that's the other thing that I'd like to speak about, that I'm happy that I learned that breakup and tone is not about so much preamp gain.
Right.
It ain't about that. You got to have enough clarity to hear what you're doing, but you know, you want it to sustain and hold a note too. So, you know, as you age, you learn a lot of things, and that's what I'm really trying to do. What I've tried to do is clean up my tone,
sure,
and play with more clarity, but also don't forget the character of sustain, man, you know?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But as we all know, it's like, how we play is how we play, and in gear, we're always going to sound like ourselves no matter what we play through. But
no matter what,
it's like, you know, gear is kind of the sonic enabler, and it can inspire to do different things. And as you said, you can do like little variations of like refining your tone and so on and so forth. But you know, if you had to play a different guitar and a different amp every night, it'd still sound like you, and that's just the way it is.
Right. And that's the main thing. That's what's most important.
Absolutely. So tell me
what
about
you using these days, Brent?
Well, that's a good question, actually. You know, for guitars, I have my Reverends. You know, I have my my T-style guitar, the Gristle Master, which is this little rascal here. Which is a slightly larger bodied Telecaster. But I developed these pickups with Fishman that are totally quiet. And there's a little button in between the volume and the tone control that gives me just a second voice to the pickups that's a little hotter and a little meatier. So I can go straight into an amp a lot of the times. And then if I just want a little bit more gas, I hit that and it just away I go. And so. Yeah. That's been my main guitar now for about 5 years, and then I developed another one with them that's more of kind of a Gibson scale, so a little the shorter scale, ebony fingerboard. It's a set neck as opposed to a bolt-on. And then I developed these pickups with Fishman as well. These are my signature P90s, which are also noise-free, and again, have a second voice that gives you a little bit more meat. And then I have this really cool out-of-phase thing as well that I can do in the middle position. So that's been a lot of fun. So those have been my main guitars. Amp-wise, I developed an amp with a Dutch company with my same last name, Kok Amps.
Cool.
And so that's been my main amp that I've been using for a while. But I've been toying around with some different things lately. I've been messing around with this little Soldano. I've got this little Tone King amp behind me I've been having fun with, which is basically like two Marshalls in one. It's got it, but instead of having a preamp distortion, it's power amp distortion. So it has an attenuator on it. So I can run I can run one channel, which as I've been doing, which is like an old JTM 45.
Yeah,
and put the volume of the of the power amp up on about 7, which would be rather loud. And then I can go back on the attenuator, so it isn't quite that loud. And then the second channel, I have more of like a 1967 Plexi, and then I crank that all the way up, and then I of course go back on the attenuator. So I have the sound of power amp gain, but I can bring the volume back because of the attenuator. And so
Do you have two transformers?
And that just has the one.
But you got two
power soaks.
Yeah. Attenuator.
Exactly.
Okay.
And that's a good sound of the lamp. So we'll see. I'm just toying around with some different things lately. We'll see what happens.
Right.
But I've got a ton of others. I mean, I got super reverbs, Vibroluxes, I got little Marshalls, I got all kinds of stuff. I did an amp with the Kauk amplifiers that we called the Little Gristle, which is a little 12. Actually, it's a, is it 12 watts? Yeah, 12 or
15.
Yeah, somewhere in that neck of the woods. But it's loud. I mean, it's a loud little amp, but you can go down to 4 watts as well. It's kind of the same controls as like a Blues Junior. But my favorite amp back in the day was the Pro Junior. Remember the one that was just the volume and the tone? And I love the way those sounds, but I love cranking the power amp on those. But those little amps just have a tendency to sound boxy when you overdrive them. So this amp, it's the cabinet is actually a little larger, so it breathes a little bit more. So it just doesn't sound as kind of nasally when you crank it. And so that's a cool little amp as well. But when I go out, my band is so freaking loud that, you know, my son hits and Toby, you know, the organ is roaring and he's playing left-hand bass. So he needs that crank so he can hear it. And then when he does leads with the Leslie, I mean, it's loud. So I found that I need at least 50 watts and 212s in order to get over the...
To compete, to be in the right range.
Exactly.
Rick, what is that little silver combo on top of that Sedona right there?
This right one right here?
Yeah,
that's the Tone King.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So on the far left are those two knobs. Those are the attenuators.
Oh, okay.
And so that's a single 12, and then I've got it going through that Saldano cabinet as well. Yeah. And it's a pretty mighty sound. And what's great about power amp distortion is that you can back off on the volume and you don't lose any highs. You know, it sounds magnifico. So that's been a lot of fun using that. I haven't used it on a gig yet though. So that's really going to be, a thing.
Yeah.
And, but that's always kind of the, you know, it's been kind of the struggle of, I think like most people would agree on, nothing sounds better than a power amp section cranked, right? But the problem is that, It's way too loud in most rooms. Yeah. And then in some rooms, it's not loud enough. Then you got nowhere else to go. And then there's some rooms where it sounds really good. And there's other rooms where it's not. I find that even though pedals don't necessarily sound as good as the actual amp overdrive, they feel better when you're playing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like you can viscerally feel when you hit that pedal and you get that boost. It's like, yeah, now I can dig in. So,
yeah.
Lately, I've been using my Kauk head, which is called the Greg, and I use the head with the 212 bottom, and I just set it clean. There's a nice reverb on the amp, and then I use my pedals to overdrive it, get a little bit of clean boosts, a little hairier boost on top of that, and then like a go for the jugular boost.
Right. Three stages.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's what's been working for me as of late. So that's what I've been using. And then I just bring an extra head along just in case something goes awry.
But
we just got back from, we were on the West Coast doing a tour and I just, you know, I set my stuff up lickety split, man. I put the head up there, the cabinet, I get my pedal board out. I put that out and I put the cabinet on the pedal board. So it's just up a little bit and I kind of know where the safe spot is in every room. I mean, I know it's going to have to be a certain amount of volume. But I've kind of got it down where I know where it needs to be. But that being said, I'm not opposed to trying new things of maybe I'll use this amp now and see what, because I just find gear inspires you in different ways, as you well know. It's like you try something new, you just sometimes, you know, overdrive on a particular amplifier, different notes take off than other amplifiers, and they just have a different feel. And so it can be inspiring in different ways. So we'll see.
Well, for sure.
We interrupt this regularly scheduled gristle infested conversation to give a special shout out to our friends at Fishman Transducers, makers of the Greg Kauk signature Fluence gristle tone pickup set. Can you dig that? And our friends at Wildwood Guitars of Louisville, Colorado, bringing the heat in the shadow of the Rocky Mountains.
You know, I got another question I want to ask you.
Yes, sir.
When did you meet Joe Naylor?
Joe Naylor, I met through Ken Haas, who's the current owner
of Reverend.
So what happened was, when I started doing those videos at Wildwood and out in Colorado, they were Reverend dealers. And when I would, you know, first of all, Ken would come out to Wildwood and do videos with me out there about once or twice a year. And then when we'd go to NAMM, I would do videos out there as well. And both Ken and Joe would be there. And that's really where I met those guys. And then after many years of just knowing them and hanging out with them, and I was doing that stuff for Fender for about 15 years. But then when I stopped kind of doing the Fender thing and I was just kind of free to do whatever I wanted, those guys were like, hey, you know, no pressure because we're pals, but if you ever wanted to do a guitar with us, we'd love to talk to you about it. And one thing led to another, and away we went. Joe's he's just brilliant. I mean, he knows how to put a guitar together that looks good and sounds great. So he's got the touch.
I met them guys years ago here too. You know, they used to be from Naylor. I haven't seen Joe in 20, 25 years.
Yeah.
But I remember when he first started out and when he had the first Naylor amps, they used to look kind of like matchlesses in the day. If you didn't know any better, you would thought it was a matchless until you take a good look and say, oh, Naylor, you know. And like that, I was just curious, you know, when y'all had met and how y'all got hooked up and stuff.
Yeah, he's a good dude, and he knows his stuff, man. I'll tell you what, we've got another guitar coming out later this year, and he knocked it out of the park again. You know, I tell him what I want, you know, and he comes up with a design. I'm like, yep, we're good.
Ain't that nice? Yeah.
So that's been a good deal. So I see that you're going to go to Australia with the Almond Betts thing. You and Allie, are you the only ones from the current lineup that's going out there?
I think from the current lineup, I don't know how it happened. I mean, you know, anytime I get picked, you know, I'm awfully happy, you know, because there's so many choices out there, you know. But, you know, sometimes being the old dog can work in your favor, I guess, as long as you ain't too old.
Exactly. Yeah. So how much stuff are you doing on the road these days, you reckon?
Well, shoot, I don't know, probably about 100 days.
Okay, yep.
Yep, something like that, probably about 100. Maybe one or two more, give or take. But I'm out there pretty regularly, you know.
Which is a good thing. So when you were just down in Georgia, you played at the old Allman Brothers haunt. So because I remember O'Teal was hanging out at that gig where I sat in with you at Summerfest, and you kind of knew those guys for a while, at least that incarnation of the Allman Brothers. Now, I was just going to say, how far back were you like a fan of the Allman Brothers and kind of knew what they were all about and maybe knew them and all that kind of stuff?
Well, I was a fan of their music in the 70s and 80s, you know, but I didn't really know a whole lot about the band, you know, just, you know, like I would come to know later in years.
Right.
But, you know, of course, when they come out with the Midnight Rider.
Right.
And then I used to listen to my girl made it to the jazz stations in my hometown. The instrumental, when they did My Girl instrumental.
Okay.
I'm trying to think of Whipping Post and Elizabeth Reed.
Yeah.
You know, I learned about them songs in the earlier days. And then how I got a chance to meet the Allman Brothers was, rest his soul, Paul Kalk was my guy at the time, taking me around different places.
That's right,
So Albert Collins and the Kinsey Report opened for the Allman Brothers at the World Theater. I forget what town it's in, just outside of Chicago. We're in Chicago.
Okay.
But it used to be a theater that called the World.
Right.
So they were playing at the World, and I went out there with them, me and Lucky Pizza. It's a strange story, man. But me, Lucky Pizza, and Russ Wheeler all hanging out together with Paul, and we went to the Allman Brothers show. So when we, Paul and Bert Holman were friends.
Okay, yeah.
And so when we got there, hey, Fatso, you want to meet Greg? And I'm like, no, I'll get on here, you big baby, go on in there and meet the man. So I got a chance to say hello to him for the first time, and that was 1992.
Okay.
When I met Greg and him. But I had met Warren before because I had did my follow-up record for Point Blank Records.
Yeah.
And I needed songs. And Paul Koch knew Doc Fields, which was Warren's first manager. And that's how I got them songs.
I got you.
Yep. Warren was, I think it was Warner Brothers he was writing for. One of them labels, he was a writer, you know.
Right.
And everything. And he sent me some songs. And then after doing it, you know, I got a chance to go down to Memphis and hang out a few days with Warren and blah, 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 you know.
Yeah.
And we became buddies. So he and I was hanging out this one day, and so I said, hey, man, how old are you? And it was the same number as mine.
Yeah.
I said, what month you born? He said, April. I said, oh, no. I said, what day? He said, April 6th. Well, my birthday is April 5th. we born 1 day apart, same year, same month, same everything.
That's so wild.
1 day is different. Yep. So I had a good connection with him. You know, he was more versed in rock and stuff like that. And I come up with the blues, but he liked the blues and played some blues. I liked the blues and tried to rock it up, tried to play, you know, so
sure.
It was a good thing that we met. And I know I learned a lot. I hope he picked up some too, but it was a good experience for me.
Nice. Now, did you open some shows for the Allman Brothers at some point or no? You sat in with them though, right?
I sat in with him on numerous occasions, and I did two different road tours with Greg.
Okay.
And I did a tour with Dickie also after the band broke up.
Got it.
So I toured with them three times. Uh-huh.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty doggone cool.
I'll never forget it, brother.
So tell me a little bit about the record you did with Joe Bonamassa and with Josh Smith and kind of how that all came about and that experience.
Wow. Well, first of all, I knew Josh when he was about 14 years old, Josh Smith.
Right.
Josh Smith was from Florida. I think he was from the West Palm area.
Right.
And His parents, Josh was one of them little playing kids, you know, one of them little bitty kids that started out playing. He probably started touring when he was about 11, 12, something along in there.
Right.
So by the time, he told me he put his first record out when he was 13. And it was called Woodshedding. So he was on a blues festival one time. I didn't know him from Adam. And when it was all sitting down, when the festival was over, you know, I met him and got a chance to talk to him and shook his hand and everything. Then after that, a lot of places I would play, here come Josh, the same little kid, you know, he playing at this same, wherever I was working at, he was working at too. So we got a chance to, you know, get acquainted and know each other. And so I knew him all the way up until he was about 19 years old. Then when he turned 19, he left the Midwest and went to California.
Right.
And when he went to California, that's when his whole life and demeanor kind of changed. He ran into some kind of jazz cat or jazz head out there somewhere that taught him how to play through changes and stuff like that. And Josh ain't been the same since.
Yeah, he's a playing fool.
Yes, he is. Yes, he is.
He's a good
man.
And
so, you know, that's how I met Josh. I met Joe B on the road, and one night I was at BB King's in Nashville. Eric Gales and Joe B came into the room. And so after I finished my gig upstairs, I went downstairs to Eric's gig and watched them play. And, you know, we talked and hung out that night and everything. And so I really didn't see Joe much until years later. But as it was in 21, Paul Cook passed away, and I had been working with him for 30-some years.
Right.
And so I was just a lost cause, you know, no direction. And some friends of mine had been told me that Joe was doing things, and why don't you try to contact Joe and this and that and other? And I'm like, man, Joe don't want to, you know, hear nothing what I got to play or anything like that. You know, Joe is such a player, you know. And it took me a long time to come to it, to get my nerve up to try to contact him. So they got me with a number, and I sent a text, and he responded back. And when he responded back, you know, it was just one thing to the next. And about probably a year later after the first text, we went in the studio together, man.
Crazy.
Yeah. And so him and Josh, they came to my house in Michigan, and they came with the intentions of writing songs. Well, I had been off on the pandemic, and I already had all the songs. Uh-huh. And so they said this is going to be a lot easier than we thought, because I had music, you know.
Right.
And so they listened to them, and we got some arrangements on the song. It was a couple of things that, you know, they had interjection. They interjected some ideas and stuff on some of the songs. So some of them aren't in total original form, but I had the whole song, the changes, you know, the outros, all that stuff. But they put some heads in there and polished it up a little bit, and we went into the studio, man.
And bing, bang, boom. Now, did you use your band, or did you use kind of a bunch of ringers?
Joe had some musicians out there in California. I got a chance to work with Mr. Reese Wyman.
Oh, yeah.
On keyboard, who works in Joe's band on every night.
Yep.
Reese was on keyboard. Travis Carlton was on bass, Larry Carlton's son.
Yep, he's great.
Lamar Carter
was
on the drum, who works with Joe right now. And come to find out, he's a Michigan boy.
Ah.
And I asked him how he got started, and he told me that his mother taught him how to play drums.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, he said his mom was a hell of a drummer. So, you know, Lamar was on drums, and Josh was on the second guitar.
Crazy.
So Joe was behind the console, but Josh, you know, pretty much worked with us on arrangement and charted out everything for the band and everything. And, you know, it was really a pretty smooth ordeal. We did the whole thing in about seven or eight days, you know, cut it, sang it, put all the dubs on it, out the door, you know, ready to awesome. Go. All of the rhythm section. Now, they added horns later.
Got it.
Yep, but all the core work was done in 7 days.
Excellent. And so did he put it out on his label then?
That's right. That's right. KTBA.
Okay, cool.
Uh-huh. On Joe's label.
Excellent.
Yeah. So I had been doing self-produced records for quite a bit. And let me see what year that. So I hadn't had a record probably for about 7 years, 7-8 years.
Oh, interesting.
So it was long overdue, and I'm glad that they got involved, because you know, the promotional factor, and just to have some help. And the more ears you got on a situation, you know, that's the cleanest it's gonna be. Sometimes when you trying to do everything yourself, it's too much.
Right. That's true. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Awesome. So that's been a couple of years ago now, right? It's been
Yeah. The record it's gonna be 3 in April. Uh-huh.
So when you're going out these days, I'm just thinking a lot, because I'm going out again next week, and it's just so wild how quickly CDs have become
obsolete,
you know. And you got all these CDs lurking, but everyone wants vinyl. But it's almost like they'll buy vinyl even if they don't have a record player. just because they want to buy it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And sometimes they'll buy. My modus operandi is with merch is, and we sell a lot of different stuff. Mm-hmm. Is that, you know, I always tell people, it's like, well, if we run out of this, this, and this, they'll buy whatever you have. You know, whatever you have, they're going to buy, which is great, which is, you know, you appreciate the support. People come out and they want to support you by buying stuff. But do you find that, are you of the mindset? Because I'm to the point now where I'm not going to print up my old library anymore. It's like I'm selling through what I have. And if I come out with new stuff, I might do a limited run of CDs, but then it's going to be vinyl. Do you find that you still sell CDs at gigs or not really?
I'm still selling CDs, Greg.
Yeah.
I'm still selling CDs and they sell them.
Yep.
But you know, I have CDs and vinyl.
Right.
But I sell more CDs. So it's still a lot of people that still have them. But I think what they do is transfer the music to their JPEGs or whatever they use, you know, flash drives or whatever they're using.
Right.
And so that way they still able to support, because as a musician, you only have so many options. Sometimes what you can get your hands on unless you're doing everything yourself.
Right.
So, you know, I do make sure that I got albums when I go out, but I definitely have CDs.
Yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I find myself like, I'm leaving next week, I go, I got to make sure I got my instructional books, I got my beanies that I wear, I got T-shirts, I got CDs, and then I sell my Gristle King pedals.
Okay.
And what else we got? I'm going to have stickers and refrigerator magnets. And I mean, it seems so weird to say all that stuff, but as you know, it's like whatever you got to sell, that just makes, it can make a mediocre night really good.
That's right. The merch is the worth, man. Yeah.
It's the thing.
I want to ask you, man, how do you find one of them Gristle King pedals?
Oh, I can set you up.
Okay.
It's a great pedal. I mean, I still, you know, it's interesting how, it's been great to use my pedal board because I can go in front of any Fender amp. I know it's going to sound. We're in Italy one time and they, you know, we had to take a train down to one particular, and all they had for me was a like an orange half stack. And I set it clean, you know, with a little bit over it, and I used my pedals. Sounded great. It's interesting how pedals interface with different amps differently. You know what I mean?
But that's exactly the case.
It's been really a good thing. It's not a real, I mean, there's a clean boost on it and then there's an overdrive.
Right.
And the clean boost, you know, I boost up a little bit, then I hit the overdrive on top of it, and it's pretty massive sounding. And it's not, you know, it's not a ton of distortion, but it's a nice amount of gain.
Well, you know, that's what I was speaking about earlier. I don't want distortion.
Right.
I want sustain,
right,
and I want the right amount of gain, you know, but I don't want to cloud up my signal so much, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, you want it clean, but you want it to sustain is basically.
Yeah, and bite just a little.
Exactly. A little bit of that sass.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, so we're going to go out for a couple, 3 weeks again. I think it's 2.5 weeks. And, you know, I got to say, I do enjoy doing it. I mean, I just, you know, when you... People always ask, I'm sure they ask you as well, don't you get tired of traveling? And I'm like, listen, when you get to go to a place and you're playing at clubs where it's not a bar where people are like, oh, look, there's a band here. You know, it's you're going to places. Yeah. The only reason why people are going there that night is to see you.
That's right.
And you get to play early. And a lot of times you're on stage at 8 o'clock. You know, by 10 o'clock, you're done. You're packing up your stuff. And you eat wherever you want. You stay wherever you want. You get to drive around and see cool stuff. And with our situation, it's just me and, you know, the two other guys, one of them being my son, which is awesome. And it's great. I mean, are you still having fun traveling? Do you enjoy doing it as much as you ever did?
Well, I'm getting ready to start doing like what you're doing, because I have a 24-year-old.
Okay.
That's ready to get out here. He's a great singer.
Nice.
He's a real strong player. And, I waited his whole life for something like this opportunity. You know, that's the same thing I'm waiting for, is to go on the road some with him.
Yeah.
And as far as the traveling stuff go, man, I love playing. I still love playing. You know, so I'm happy to be able to do what I'm doing. But by the same token, it makes me appreciate home even more, too. So when
absolutely.
home, you know, my baby's welded to my hip, you know, and we, you know, we spend, it's important for me to have good days at home and to do quality things with her.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
Does your gal go with you on trips very often or no?
Oh yeah, we get a chance to do a lot of things together. And the biggest thing that just happened to me lately, I don't know how these people got a hold of me, but through the power of the Lord or something, man. I believe it was from the Almond Best Revival. I believe they had to have, or maybe they just saw me at a gig. But anyway, somebody knew my music, and somebody got a hold of me from Nickelodeon.
Oh, nice!
And I got a character role on one of their programs.
No way!
It's a little comedy sitcom. And I played the role of this old blues guy named Buddy Perkins, old grumpy blues man with a hat and some glasses and all this stuff, you know. So when it was a shot in Albuquerque, and so when I went out there, I spent 12 days out there, and you know, Peg got a chance to go. We were out there together for 12 days.
Nice.
She was right there to help me, you know, when I needed stuff, and it was a great experience for both of us.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So has that come out yet?
No, it won't be out until they say August, September. I'll talk to you about it when we finished up the cast, because they don't want you to say nothing, you know, until they tell you it's time to say something.
Oh, I got you. No problem.
Yeah, yeah. But I'll fill you in on everything.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, that's just fun right there.
Buddy Perkins, I told him, call me Smack Over Kid.
So, you reckon you'll be doing another Almond Betts thing this fall again, or what do you think?
Well, if I get the call, I will. You know, I know they have to rotate their musicians and stuff like that. But like I said, you know, it's perfect for old geezer like me, because first of all, I get a chance to hang around with some really cool people that I probably never would get a chance to otherwise, you know, and see other musicians that you never get to see because you're always trying to work yourself.
Right.
You know, so if I get the call, I'll do it again.
Yeah, I had a ball. I had a ball last year. I had a ball this year.
Yeah.
And it's just good times. You know, it's a good bunch of people. The music's great. And boy, you know, it's just so wild, the legacy of that music and how people just love it, you know, and they're out there. They just eat it up.
Well, look at the GABA convention. You know about that, huh?
The which one?
GABA.
No.
Georgia Almond Brothers Association, G-A-B-B-A. G-A-B-A, GABA.
Okay, GABA, gotcha.
Georgia Almond Brothers Association. And so what it is, every day, every year, once a year in Macon, Georgia, I don't know how many days it is, it's a week or 10 days or whatever, they have bands come from all over the country, all over the world, that assemble in Macon, Georgia, kind of the home
base. Right, the home base, yep.
And they rent out a theater, and they have all these different performances, and for them days that they in town, the whole town is all about GABA.
That's crazy.
Yep. So last year I ran into Leroy Parnell.
Yeah.
There and Sonny Mormon, and you know I know Leroy and Sonny, and you know it was Bruce Katz.
Okay. Yeah.
It was a ton of musicians there, man, and they all playing at this theater, and they playing Almond Brother music.
That's wild.
And it's to all sold out audiences.
That's awesome.
That's crazy.
We did the tour of the Big House last year.
Uh-huh.
And it was on a day where it was closed, but Richard opened it up for us because I called up Devin. I said, Devin, you got any pull with the Almond Brothers Museum? He's like, hell yeah, what do you want to do? And I told him, he's like, no problem. He goes, the guy knows who you are. He's kind of a fan. You know, it'll be no problem to give you a tour of the place. And man. Right. It was awesome. There's definitely vibes in that town.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, they Macon claim that they invented rock and roll, southern rock, and funk. Because, right. You know, James Brown's supposed to be there from there, but they say he really from Augusta.
Right.
But exactly. Anyway, making claims, and, you know, so James Brown, Little Richard,
yeah.
And the Allman Brothers.
Yep.
You know, with the Southern Rock, you know. They.
Right.
So who knows, you know?
Who knows?
Yeah.
That's crazy. Crazy stuff. Well, I'm looking forward to heading down to that area next week. Of course, anytime, as you well know, being where we're from, anytime you get to go down south during the wintertime, I'm all for it.
Oh, man, for sure. That's what Peg was saying to me the other day. She said, you missed all the bad days. You always gone when it's bad weather. I feel kind of bad. But I've been lucky for that this year, you know?
Yeah, I've been lucky too. I mean, I had that cold snap, you know, where it was really, really cold. And then we got that week where we got pummeled with snow.
Right.
And then it was really, really bitter cold. And that's right when we left town. Right. I remember when I was driving from Omaha to Denver. When we started off in Denver, it was like -8. And by the time we drove to Denver, when we got a little while outside of Denver, it was 47 degrees. So it had changed that much.
Yeah, from Omaha to Denver.
Yeah, it was crazy. Yeah. And then ever since it was perfectly fine. And then we went down to Arizona, and then we were in Southern California doing a bunch of different stuff for about 6-7 days. And then we moved up into the Bay Area. But we managed to get lucky because all those torrential rains came the day after we left L.A. And so we were up north. And then when that second wave came, where it was really bad, we were in Nevada City, which wasn't horrible. And then we found a little place we went up to Redding and kind of rode the storm out before we headed north up to Oregon. But we got lucky. And then on the way back, you know, we had to take that northern route. We drove back from, you know, Portland all the way to Minneapolis to drop off Toby and then back to Milwaukee. And we lucked out, man. The weather, you know, there was no ice on the road. There was no snow. It was great. But that's, you know, I get traumatized. I remember this one time when we were driving into Phoenix, you know, it was another one of these things where it was the same time of year, and we were driving south, and I was like, as soon as we got into Texas and started, you know, turning west, I'm like, we made it, no problem. And all of a sudden we're getting into New Mexico, and it's kind of getting the nighttime. I'm like, is that snow?
Oh,
and then I didn't know that area between like some part of New Mexico and however my navigation was sending me through Flagstaff down into Phoenix. And there was a snowstorm. It was absolutely terrifying.
Okay. And to be on the road and then have the pressure of trying to get to somewhere on time, you know, that's not a good feeling.
No, but we made it. But every time now I'm always very conscious of the weather before we start heading out, like, what's the weather going to be like? Because it's, especially this time, because my van that I just bought hadn't come in yet because there was a snag in the modifying the van to put some seats in it. So they gave me a rental, which was rear wheel drive.
Ooh.
Right? And I was like, nope, I got to go over the Rockies twice. But luckily, both times we had to go, there was no snow. So,
oh, good for you, man.
Or else that would have been terrifying. Well, listen, Larry, thanks so much for spending some time. It was an absolute pleasure.
And I wish we had got a chance to do this again. You call me again sometime, we'll do this.
Absolutely. Well, I hope we get to play together again soon. That'd be fun. It'd be fun to do some shows. You know, I had that house gig at that place down in Chicago where we were having special guests, and that is not happening anymore. But maybe we'll find another excuse to get together and do it anyway.
Okay. Well, hey, and if nothing else, you know, maybe if next time we're doing a project, recording project, if I can catch it right and all that stuff, if the stars line up, maybe, you know, we could be on a record together or something
like that.
That would be great.
I'd absolutely love it. That'd be great.
For sure, my brother. For sure.
All right. Well, listen, great to see you. You take care of yourself. Travel safe. And we'll hopefully see you soon.
Nothing but love, my brother. You take care.
Likewise. Have a good one, Larry. See you later. Folks, thanks so much for tuning in. We certainly do appreciate you stopping by and partaking in the most savory, chewable gristle this side of Cucamonga. Gregory Kauk, looking forward to seeing you again next week. Even though I won't actually see you, but I'll sense your presence.